Well, once again, it's good to see all of you here and partaking of the teaching as we work our way through the confession. And this week we are on a topic that some people have found controversial, and throughout history it actually has been somewhat controversial. But the reality is that I believe the scriptures are quite clear as we look to chapter 9 of free will. This morning we're going to be looking at this, these five short paragraphs, but they are very, very loaded with good information. The reading of it is really quite clear, but there's a lot to say about it. As we've gone through the confession early on, I said essentially the confession is a systematic theology. It tells us what God has revealed to us in various areas. And the first of the four units that we talked about, the first six chapters, were the first principles, those basic things that we need to know about God and about man. And the next number of chapters, chapters 7 all the way through chapter 20, spoke of the covenant. And those things that we will be talking about again next week, talked about last week on the mediator, next week on the call, effectual call, justification, and so forth, are all related to the covenant by which God is relating to his creation. The next set of chapters talk about life in this age, talk about the church and how we relate both to God and to one another. And then the last two chapters about the next life, the things to come, eternity. So as we begin, I'd like to give credit to the sources that I've studied this past week and prior to that, again, having Dr. Renahan's exposition, utilized that, utilized a book from R.C. Sproul, Willing to Believe. I highly recommend it to you. It gives us a historical background of the arguments made on free will. Also, I have a number of quotes from Nehemiah Cox and even Augustine, going all the way back to the 4th and 5th centuries. So let's begin there right away and jump right in to paragraph 1 of Free Will, chapter 9. It reads such, God has endued the will of man with that natural liberty and power of acting upon choice, that it is neither forced nor by any necessity of nature determined to do good or evil. Now, when we've talked about free will, I'm sure that you've had conversations with others, and the question arises, what about free will? As you talk about the doctrines of grace, but doesn't that oppose my free will? The argument is that free will is important to people, and I would agree with that. I am in whole agreement with the reality that we do have free will. The question is then, what does that mean? And the reality is that we have free will. Deuteronomy speaks of it in Deuteronomy chapter 30, verse 29. Therein we read, and this is God speaking to the nation of Israel. Remember two sessions ago, I had suggested that we read our Bible covenantally, and you're going to hear covenantal language as we read this passage. God says, I call heaven and earth to witness against you today that I have set before you life and death, blessing and curse. There you have the idea of covenant. Therefore, choose life. You have free will to choose life. that you and your offspring may live, loving the Lord your God, obeying his voice, and holding fast to him. For he is your life and length of days, that you may dwell in the land that the Lord swore to your fathers. So there we have an example in the Old Testament of the reality that we have opportunity to choose. Choose between good and evil, that we have opportunity to make a moral choice. And that's really what free will is. If we were to define it, it's freedom to choose. Freedom to choose. The power, the ability to act on that choice. And God is the source, because we read again from the Confession, paragraph 1, it begins, God has endued the will of man with natural liberty and power. He is the source. He has gifted. He has empowered. He has invested in man the freedom, the liberty to make choices and to act on them. So God did not create creatures who will to do only that which is good or evil, but rather that he has created creatures who have the ability to do good or evil. And this is without any coercion at all. As the Confession says, it is not forced. So therefore, we understand that in all circumstances, man is totally free. And we'll work our way through the different states of man this morning, and to understand that in all circumstances, man is totally free to choose. As Cox has stated in his Vindicae Veritas, I do acknowledge that all men have a liberty of will or freedom of choosing with reference to those things that are proposed to them. And this I take to be an inseparable part of all human acts. He further says, this liberty consists in a rational spontaneity. He acts freely, that is, under no coercion, which alone is opposed to liberty in the true notion thereof. No coercion, but doth what the last and practical judgment of his own understanding dictates to him. These are important words. We'll get back to them. So that one that acts necessarily may yet act most freely. God cannot but love and delight in his creature who obeys him, and he does order all things to his own glory, yet he is an agent in every respect most absolutely free. The good angels, now confirmed by grace in their station, and glorified saints, cannot but love God, choose and delight in perfect obedience to his holy will. Yet in all this they are free agents, because they are thus determined by no external force, but by the dictate of their own understanding. And on the contrary, the devils and fallen man are by their own wickedness determined to sin, and that only, yet are free in the choice thereof. So man chooses. The rational man has freedom to choose. He acts freely and does that which is he deems by his own understanding in his best interest. Man chooses, in other words, according to his nature. And this is an important point. Don't miss this. Man chooses according to his nature. And as we'll find with Augustine, he says that they choose according to their desires, or that which they think is of best for them. Man chooses according to his nature in all circumstances. In paragraph 2, we'll talk about how man chooses in his innocence, that is, Adam and Eve. And then in paragraph 3, how man chooses after the fall. Paragraph 4, how man exercises his free will after he has been redeemed. And finally, in paragraph 5, how man exercises his free will in eternity. So let's step into paragraph 2, and this is man in his innocency. We read, "Man, in his state of innocency, had freedom and power to will and do that which was good and well-pleasing to God." He had the power to obey God, but yet was mutable so that he might fall from it, that he was changeable. He had the power to obey God in that state of innocency. And for a period, Adam and Eve did just that. How long? We don't know. The scriptures does not reveal that. He did have that power. And it was a natural ability. And as the confession says, the freedom and the power to will and do that which is good, that which is well-pleasing to God. So, in other words, the way man was created, the way Adam and Eve were created, they were upright. Remember in Genesis, after creation was completed, God says it was very good. Adam was an upright man, and he had the capacity to yield perfect obedience to all of God's commands, and according to the covenant in which he stood. And as we have talked about before, at that point, that was the covenant of works. And again, referring to Genesis chapter 2, wherein God had commanded Adam not to eat of the knowledge of the tree of good and evil, wherein if he ate of it, he would surely die. Very explicit. The implication was that if he obeyed, did not eat of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, he would have lived. So, they had that potential then to change. They were mutable. They were not confirmed in the state in which God had created them. And we as Baptists, and the particular Baptists of the 17th century, would confess that not only was their will changed, but every part of man was changeable. Again, something that we will get to in the next paragraph. Not just his will. So Adam was created in a state of posse peccari, posse non peccari. That is, possibility to sin and the possibility to not sin. He had that power and that ability. And we know, of course, that Adam did choose to sin. And that's why we move to chapter 9 and in paragraph 3, because Adam did sin. Man, by his fall into a state of sin, has wholly lost all ability of will to any spiritual good accompanying salvation, so as a natural man, being altogether averse from that good and dead in sin, is not able by his own strength to convert himself or to prepare himself thereunto. And we're going to spend a fair amount of time in this particular paragraph because that's the state in which we live. Adam fell and man along with him. So in this paragraph, we're going to understand the effect of Adam's sin. And that is, in short, our inability to choose God. Our nature is such that we have no ability to choose God. We still have freedom of choice, and we choose according to our nature. But by our fallen nature, we will not choose God. And our understanding of grace and our understanding of our free will depends on a good understanding of the doctrine of original sin. I'll say that again because this is very important. When you have an argument about what about free will, this is a statement that you need to rely on. Our understanding of our free will is dependent on our careful understanding of original sin. Because after the fall, everything about man changed. everything. He became mortal. That is to say, that he would die, physically die. His relationship to God changed in every way. He experienced spiritual death. An enmity then existed between God and man that did not exist before. He experienced pain. He experienced sickness. He experienced toil and sorrow and conflict. And everything about him changed as well, all around him. All of creation changed. It did not yield in the same manner as it did before. So when it says in paragraph 3 that man, by his fall, understand that is not limited to Adam himself, because there it's speaking of mankind. All of mankind fell with Adam. We understand from the doctrines of grace, the 5 points of Calvinism, we talk about total depravity. And we also understand from that 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 does not mean that we are as depraved as we could be in terms of our sin. We're not as bad as we could be. There's things that limited our propensity to sin, such as the laws that are around us, also the laws of God written on our heart. But what it does mean is that sin affects every part of our being. In that sense, it's radical. In that sense, it's a radical depravity. And our will is changed such that we no longer have the ability to choose the things of God. So it's a radical inability is really where we're at. No part of our nature will cause us to choose God, because their nature had changed. So it is with all of mankind. So we read a few things, we can get a few things out of this paragraph. And the first of that is that there was a real Adam and Eve. We read about the historicity of Adam and Eve. They were real people. There was a real fall, and there are real consequences. And we speak also from this paragraph about the reality of federal headship. That is that Adam, in his position in the covenant of works, was the head of all of mankind. In fact, as we know, that's exactly what his name means, mankind. And he stood in the place of all mankind. And as Adam goes, so goes all his posterity. So goes you and I. Adam's fall affected all men. It has affected us. We know this to be true, and we've gone there before, but I'll briefly go there in Romans chapter 5 and verse 12. We read, "Therefore, just as sin came into the world through one man, and death through sin, and so death spread to all men because all sinned." That is to say, all sinned in Adam. That's what we're talking about when we talk about original sin. Verses 18 and 19, the beginning of each of those verses. "As one trespass led to condemnation for all men." And then verse 19, "For as by one man's disobedience, the many were made sinners." We aren't sinners because we sin. We sin because we are sinners. That is our nature. That is our nature. In John 6, in the New Testament, I guess Romans was New Testament as well, but in John 6, we read in, I believe it's 6, verse 65. This is Jesus speaking. "This is why I told you that no one can come to me unless it is granted him by the Father." This speaks to our inability, again, our radical inability to seek after the things of God. No one. Who is that? No one. No one can come to me. No one has the power to come to the Father unless it is granted, unless there is a work of the Father, unless it is gifted. And the word actually has a nuance wherein no one has the power or ability to come to the Father unless a particular thing happens that God would grant or gift or compel us to come on to Him, because our nature would not allow us to do that. Now, this doctrine of total of freedom of the will certainly was not one without conflict or controversy throughout history. And I'm going to go all the way back to the 4th and 5th century to a man named Pelagius. Now, I'm going to lay the groundwork for Pelagius and what he believed, and then follow that up for those who backed off of that. Yet, Pelagius influenced them, and those are issues that we are dealing with to this very day. Now, Pelagius was a man that was born in Ireland in the late 4th century. And he was a monk, he was a eunuch, he was a contemporary of Augustine. And Augustine had written a prayer that said, "Grant what thou commandest, doth command, and command what God doth desire. Grant what thou commandest, and command what you do desire." Now, Pelagius had no problem with the second part of that prayer, asking God to command what He desires. After all, He is God. He is sovereign. And He is the Creator. Pelagius had no problem with that whatever. But the first part of the prayer was a real problem for Pelagius. Grant what thou dost command. In praying that, he was saying that we need something from God in order to be obedient to Him. Because Pelagius believed that God commands nothing that is impossible. So Pelagius, in my view, had a complete misunderstanding of the purpose of the law, that which he does command, as well as the Bible text that would argue against some of the things that he believed. Now, here are some of the things that he believed, and you will have no problem rejecting all of them, I would hope. And this is just a taste of it. There's much, much more, but these are highlights, and they're still enough of them to be concerned about it. Pelagius said, everything that God creates is good. We can go there. Yet, man was created mortal and would die, regardless of whether he obeyed all of God's commands or not. Yet, we understand, again, from Genesis 2, that death came from the result of disobedience. As created, nature cannot be changed, essentially. If that's the case, why do we have the new birth required? Jesus said, you must be born again. Because the nature of man had fallen, and that nature needed to be made alive. And furthermore, in 1 Peter chapter 1, verse 18, we read that we have inherited the futile ways of our forefathers. If man is created good, there are no futile ways. Nature is indestructibly good. Romans 3, what does it say? There are none righteous. There's no one who understands. There's no one who does good. There's no one who seeks God. Not even one. How many? No one. Not even one. Sin comes via satanic snares and sensuous lust. Well, that in and of itself might be partially true, but then he would also argue that there can be no sinless man. There's no original sin. Man is created just as, or is born just as Adam was created, in innocency, without sin. And if all sin comes from Satan and sensuous lust, that is saying that the sin is out there. The problem is out there, when in reality, the problem is right here. We are born with the consequences of Adam's sin. Furthermore, Romans 5:23 said, all have sinned and fall short of the glory of God. There can be no sinless man born of ordinary generation. Adam's progeny did not inherit from him natural death. Neither Adam's sin nor his guilt was transmitted. And we've already looked at Romans chapter 5 to argue against that. Adam, all men are created as Adam before the fall. Yet Psalm 51 says that we were brought forth in iniquity and sin did my mother conceive me. The grace of God facilitates goodness, but is not necessary to achieve it. Ephesians 2, we are saved by grace through faith. The grace of creation yields perfect men, yet 1 Corinthians chapter 2, verse 14 says that the natural man does not accept the things of God. They are folly to him. He is not able to understand it, and he has no spiritual discernment. The grace of God's law illuminates and instructs, when in fact the purpose of God's law, according to Romans chapter 3, is to say that we do not have any ability whatever. And lastly, grace is given according to justice and merit. Ephesians 2, 8 and 9, saved by grace through faith, not of ourselves, gift of God, not of works, not of grace, of merit. No, we are saved by God's grace. So, for Pelagius, and this is the final statement I will have for him, free will, properly exercised, leads to virtue. And man, by his free will, can achieve whatever required of him in morality and in religion. Well, this was clearly not accepted by the church. Pelagius holds the distinction of having been condemned by on more continents by more church councils than any man in history. And Augustine, again, his contemporary, using the scriptures, acknowledged that man is a moral being. Our mind and our will make moral choices. And man was created in the image of God and has the ability to choose between good and evil. And man possesses free will without external constraint. And that freedom, therefore, leads to responsibility. And the sinner is free to choose. This is the paradox. The sinner is free to choose, yet he is enslaved to sin. There's a freedom in choice because man believes in his sinful state that the best choice is not God. He believes that the real choice, the best choice, is himself and his sin. And Scripture tells us that in his freedom to sin, he is in bondage to that sin. He is a slave to his own evil passions, and he makes choices. But again, from Ephesians 2, man being spiritually dead will never make spiritually correct choices. Man is spiritually bankrupt and without ability to choose God. And as Augustine says, he is freely in bondage. And this is what Augustine wrote in his essay on free will. He identified pleasure or desire as the crucial element in the will's bondage to sin. The sinner chooses what he desires or what is pleasing to him. In this sense, the sinner is still free to do what he wants to do, but because he has no desire for righteousness, he is in spiritual bondage. He is in bondage to himself, to his own sinful desires. So for Augustine to move from a state of freedom, where we're at in our nature, freedom to sin, to a state of liberty, God must exercise his grace. And this makes the unwilling sinner willing to now freely choose God, only by God's grace. And it begins with rebirth. Next week we'll talk about the effectual call. Jonathan will be here in my absence, and he'll be speaking about that first step in salvation, the effectual call of God to the elect. Augustine's goal in all this was to preserve divine grace and the sovereignty of God. So Pelagius was rejected. I mean, his positions were extreme. But that didn't mean that some of the things that Pelagius believed and taught were done away with. So man, in his not godly wisdom, but in his ungodliness, backed off to what we would call semi-Pelagianism. And I'm bringing that up because that very thing affects some of the things that we deal with today. So Pelagius says that you need no grace. Those who were semi-Pelagian, Cassian, sometimes known as Cassianism, would believe that, well, we may need some grace, but man still plays a part in these initial steps of his salvation. In other words, was it all God, or was there a cooperation between God and man? And that gives rise to another couple of terms that we need to be familiar with, and that is monergism and synergism. When you talk about monergism, and you spell it, it's M-O-N-E-R-G-I-S-M. And synergism also has in the middle part of it the word E-R-G. Now, what is that? An erg is a measure of energy. And energy is defined as the ability to do work. So the erg is a measure of work. And when you talk about monergism, you're talking one doing the work, or synergism, where you have two or more cooperating to do a work. And in the theological arena, when we're talking about monergism, we're talking about our salvation. Is it a work of God alone, or is it a work of cooperation between God and man? And that's the argument when we're talking about semi-Pelagianism. That's the argument when we're talking about the Papist or from Rome. That's the argument that we're talking about in a little bit different sense of Arminianism. What part does man play in his salvation? Or put in terms of today's topic, what part does man's will play in bringing him into salvation? The semi-Pelagian would argue that sin has crippled the human will. Yet, we still have freedom. And with God's grace, with God's assistance, with God's infused power, along with our will, we can come to an understanding of who God is. We cooperate with God in order to turn with Him. The sinner is not spiritually dead, but the sinner is weakened. The sinner, his will is sick. And therefore, the cooperative effort between God and man the synergistic effort produces salvation or a movement towards God. Augustine, on the other hand, would have argued that, no, we're not just sick. Our spirit is dead. And that's exactly what Ephesians 2 says, isn't it? We are dead in our trespasses and our sins. And Augustine would argue that it takes divine grace to change the heart, wherein he made us alive, wherein he has raised us up with him and seated us with him in heavenly places. This divine grace, this monergistic action of God alone makes believers want to believe. It changes the will of the believers. Again, coming back to that very argument that I made early on, that human will always acts according to its nature. And it takes that regeneration to change our nature in order for us to come to God. And this regeneration comes before faith, because we can have no faith apart from the work of God in our regeneration. Clearly, this is monergistic at the beginning point of our salvation. It is the work of God alone. And this controversy continued throughout history. At the Council of Orange in 529, the church, the papist, clearly rejected Pelagianism. And they rejected some of the semi-Pelagian positions. But Rome left open man's will to cooperate with God's grace. You do the best you can, and God will infuse the grace necessary to bring you over the finish line. So that is still part of what we see today. And furthermore, there was others in history. Luther wrote The Bondage of the Will as he clashed with Erasmus. Calvin said that we were voluntary slaves. The canons of the Synod of Dort refuted Arminius and his position. In fact, it is said that Arminianism is the road back to Rome. So history is replete with all of these arguments about free will, and it all hinges, it all focuses on the reality that our will, what we choose, is related to our nature. And our nature, in its fallen state, will never choose God. It takes God's monergistic work to bring us to salvation. Again, back to paragraph 3. Man, by his fall into the state of sin, has wholly lost all ability of will to do any spiritual good accompanying salvation. So man at that point is in a position of non posse, non peccari, not possible to not sin. And man does not seek God. We've already talked about Romans 3 and that we do not seek God, we do not understand. And Romans 1:18, in fact, it says that we go a step further. We actively suppress the truth of God's word. We cannot reach God on our own. Which brings us to paragraph 4. Man in a redeemed state, in a state of grace. When God converts a sinner and translates him into the state of grace, he frees him from his natural bondage under sin, and by his grace alone enables him freely to will and do that which is spiritually good. Yet, so as that by reason of his remaining corruption, the corruption that remains in his flesh, he does not perfectly not only will that which is good, but does also will that which is evil. So, man in a state of grace, where we are transferred from the covenant of works, our own works, to a covenant of grace, and we're depending on Christ's work, that this conversion changes a man. He is spiritually dead and brought to spiritual life, to a state of grace, to a saving grace. In fact, in Colossians chapter 1, we read in verse 13, He has delivered us from the domain of darkness and transferred us to the kingdom of His beloved Son, in whom we have redemption, the forgiveness of sin. In that transfer from one kingdom to another, that transfer from one federal head to another, from the first Adam to the last Adam, we have a freedom from the slavery of sin and the sin nature. It enables the will to understand. Remember, we couldn't understand. Enables the will to choose good, to choose righteousness, none of which we could do in the state of a fallen state, and chooses to seek after God. Again, we talk about 1 Corinthians 2, where the natural man has no ability to seek after God because those things of God are spiritually discerned. And now our spirit is alive and awakened, and we have that ability. And it's by grace and grace alone. It's a monergistic work of God. Yet, the paragraph tells us that sin remains in our flesh. In Hebrews 12, in verse 4, it says, in your struggle against sin, that reality is still there. We still struggle with sin that remains in our flesh. That struggle against sin, you have not yet resisted to the point of shedding your blood, even as Christ has shed His blood. So at this point, as we are in a state of grace, living in this age, we are back to the position of posse peccari, posse non peccari. Possible to sin, but now we have the possibility that we can obey God and choose good and choose God. The last paragraph, I'll spend very little time on that. I'm sure our time is about up. This will of man is made perfectly and immutably free to good alone in the state of glory alone. We are still free, but our will is now not changeable. It's different. It's better than when Adam was in the state of innocency. We are confirmed in this grace, and we will only choose good, and we will always glorify God. And we are in a state of non-posse peccari, not possible to sin. That's what the future holds for us, church. So what have we learned this morning? In all four states, man is and has always been truly free. And that man acts or chooses according to his nature. Therefore, a right understanding of original sin is necessary to help us understand that we cannot have no power, no ability to seek after God in that state. But our changed nature in regeneration solely by God's monergistic work is the only efficient cause to incline us to seek the things of God and to choose God. And in glory, we are confirmed in grace to never sin again and only choose God to seek after good, that is, the glory of God. We have free will. We've always had free will. Always according to our nature. I choose always according to our nature. And it is God's work alone that has brought us back to a position where we can choose Him and choose good. Is that good or not? That's good.